Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Columbus Urban League was founded in 1918 with the goal in part of helping African Americans adjust to city life and find financial stability. They were up against a serious challenge, however, the impact of which endures even today. It's called redlining. Joining us is CEO and president of the Columbus Urban League, Stephanie Hightower. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Also, assistant professor of city and regional planning at Ohio State University's Knowlton School of Architecture and director of research for the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity, Jason Reese. Welcome back.
Thank you.
We are talking about redlining today. That it comes from a Federal Housing Administration back during the New Deal. We're going to talk about what it means. If you or somebody you know, did you grow up in a redline neighborhood? Give us a call. Tell us your story, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So I said that redlining first came from the Federal Housing Administration, at least in an official way. Stephanie Hightower, what is redlining?
Well, I think it is a real form of discrimination. Basically, that's what it is. I mean, at the end of the day, and I think probably Jason can give you the more
technical. Well, it's a policy.
Technical,
it's a set of policies.
Yeah. So if you look back in the 1930s, the term actually comes from the color they used on the maps during this time period. And you have the federal government about to interject itself into the housing market in the aftermath of the Depression. And they do something that seems really logical at first. And they have these neighborhood appraisals done all over the country, about 230-some cities. And as part of those appraisals, unfortunately, what we see is the racism of the day firmly embedded into the language of how these
no
neighborhoods.
No compunction.
Oh, very
it's
clear.
Right, in, it's
right,
in the documentation,
right out in the
everything, right.
Yeah. I mean, it's it's really blatant. And I'll say, you know, we unfortunately have lost the historical documents for Columbus that kind of do these neighborhood descriptions. But I've looked at the neighborhood descriptions probably in several dozen cities. And Cleveland's a great example where you'll see appraisers write about how, you know, two black children walk through this neighborhood to reach school. And that's too much of a risk for them to, you know, give this neighborhood a good rating. Very clear, very just outright. And I say, you know, you enter into the mind of a real estate professional in the 1930s, and it's a scary place to be.
Mm-hmm. The FHA, the Federal Housing Administration, justified redlining by saying that if African Americans bought homes in suburbs or even near suburbs, property values of the homes they were insuring, that is the white homes, would fall, putting their loans at risk. But that really wasn't the case, right?
No. The I like to consider this kind of the great lie, right? So there was a concerted effort in the turn of the century to really kind of spread this dogma around segregation as philosophically and scientifically being the way cities should function. The real estate industry buys into that. And so the emerging National Association, what would become the National Association of Realtors, starts to embed this ideology into their training materials as early as the 1920s. And so you have this kind of lie that's basically embedded in our real estate practices, and it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy because of the way we arranged policies then to punish African-American communities in particular and reward those communities that kept themselves racially segregated.
The Urban League, the Columbus Urban League, had been around for about 18 years by the time this Federal Housing Administration policy came into effect. Was anyone even really aware of what was happening?
You know,
Stephanie Hightower?
You know, when you go back and you look at what was going on at that time, you know, that was during the time of the Great Migration.
Yeah.
And so you had African Americans
from the South
coming up, sharecroppers, coming up from the South, you know, going either on the East Coast, coming up through the Midwest, going on the West Coast. And so the Urban League at that time really was concentrating on finding places for people to live. Looking at work opportunities, looking at educational activities. And so when you have this huge migration of African Americans who are all flocking to this organization trying to basically deal with basic needs, that's when, to the point that Jason raised, you can start to begin to embed these policies to ensure that these folks who are coming up from the South actually are congregated in one place so that they don't come into a community or into a city and basically spread out the way they would if they were had been down South.
Well, yes, except that there was also a natural inclination, and there always is, for people moving in large numbers to a city or something to be together. So again, there's sort of this invisibility about it too, that's natural for a while, but then once people want to break away, move into a nicer neighborhood or whatever it might be, that's when they start to realize.
Yeah, and I think also, though, we have to, if you look at the geography of Columbus around the turn of the century or even up to about 1920, the African-American community was actually kind of widely distributed in the city. We had pockets of African-American neighborhoods on the south side, on the hilltop, up where Flytown used to be, as well as on the east side. But as Stephanie was saying, as the population grows, then you start to see this whole framework of policies get put in place to make sure that they're contained. And this is where we see kind of the growth of the East Side during this time period. And, from about 1910 to the end of the 1930s, the African-American population quadruples here in Columbus. So it's a very sizable population shift from the Great Migration.
It's contained on the East Side, but then there's another issue that pops up, and I want to keep talking about redlining, but that's how they built the highway system.
Yes. There you go.
Yeah.
And that compounds a lot of problems.
Absolutely.
How so?
Well, for one thing, if you think about the decisions that get made a couple of decades later in terms of urban renewal projects where they demolished vast swaths of neighborhoods, or, where to put these highways, who's going to lose as we build the interstate highway system? Well, for planners at this time, those redlining maps become a real roadmap to thinking about how they lay out the highway system. And in fact, you can take our current highway system and drop it over the 1930s redlining map, and it neatly fits over those neighborhoods that were basically redlined during that time period. They become expendable. And then, as we know, later, the demolition, the isolation of those communities from the highways proves to be terribly destructive.
Highway construction, we know there's a 1952 document from the Ohio Department of Transportation that shows the Franklin County Regional Planning Commission intentionally protected Bexley when building the freeway.
So, again, just that blatant discrimination. When you don't have African-Americans or people of color who are sitting at the table when these kinds of decisions are being made, then by the time the communities look up and see what's going on, it's been legislated. People haven't really figured out what the real end game actually is because nobody of color is sitting at the table to help make that decision.
Was anybody protesting those policies at the time?
I mean, certainly there would be some resistance, but, as Stephanie notes, the organized resistance that maybe we might expect today, probably it's not. And you have to think about, too, that folks were in this situation. I mean, you still had a lot of folks were renting in these communities. And so, the fact that, there's a reason why Bexley gets protected, and that's because of its economic clout and its political clout. And so, the loudest voices, unfortunately, kind of ruled the decision making at that time. And so many of these communities, again, become very expendable as we build our infrastructure for the 20th century.
The more diverse a city, the more redlining.
Yeah, well, so, what you see is that, and this is when you dive into the assessor notes from back in this time period, two concepts. One, as we said, this the power of this dogma around segregation. And redlining emerges, as well as the use of covenants during this time period, as a way of pushing back against the Great Migration. And these restrictive covenants were placed on real estate deeds to enforce segregation, right? And so when you go into the redlining maps, what you'll often find are the actual assessments, you'll find that neighborhoods that do get positive ratings, they'll note that they're well restricted. And that's code from that time period to say there's restrictive covenants in place. And so you'll see language like that in terms of neighborhoods, you know, let's say like in Upper Arlington, where there were restrictions in place, as well as Bexley. You know, if you think about the dynamics of this time period, too, you see the way race was really kind of conceptualized. So if you look at notes from up in Cleveland, you see a lot of discrimination against Eastern Europeans and the Jewish population. You see a lot of anti-immigrant bias mm-hmm. embedded within these things as well, a very intense nativism. And you have to think, just prior to this time period, we were at the pinnacle of the Klan in the 20th century, particularly here in the Midwest.
And, you know, you could also, you know, it's funny that I'm glad that you mentioned that it wasn't just about people of color, but if you also looked at the immigrant population and especially the Jewish community and, you know, there's a, you know, individual businessman in our community who has now helped to build this community in a significant way, who, if you've ever had an opportunity to hear some of his remarks and presentations, he talks about the fact that, you know, there was a time period when he could not buy in Sessions Village. And, you know, he openly talks about that. He's spoken at a couple of the African American Leadership Academy graduations, and he talks about how he, too, was impacted by those covenants and redlining, you know, as a Jewish American citizen, too. So it really wasn't just about people of color, but it was about the immigrant population as well. And, you know, we see some of those things, you know, things happening today as it relates to our immigrant population in this country.
We're going to continue our conversation and find out why, how the redlining policies that emerged during the Depression by way of the New Deal affected the way our city looks even today. So stay with us. And if you have a story to tell, you know, about redlining in your own family, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Columbus Urban League is celebrating 100 years this year, and the organization was founded to help African Americans seek financial stability in a rapidly changing world. But that was a challenge when the cards became officially stacked against them during the New Deal era. The Federal Housing Administration made it policy to force blacks into certain neighborhoods and away from others. It's called redlining, and the now illegal practices of redlining have had ripple effects to this day. Still with us is CEO and President of the Columbus Urban League, Stephanie Hightower, and also Director of Research for the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State, Jason Reese. We would like to hear from you if you have a question or comment. Do you know, have a personal experience with redlining? It's certainly an issue today, and it has a lot to do with what our city looks like. Why is that, Jason Reese? Why does that, the impact, even though it's illegal now, why does the impact endure?
Well, two very drastic effects. One is that the policy actually was in place for almost half a century. And even after the 1968 Fair Housing Act, it still, to some degree, plays some role in shaping where investment goes up until we get a Community Reinvestment Act in the 1970s. So if you think about this in terms of what makes a neighborhood healthy, neighborhoods have to have capital. They need money for investment. They need function functioning housing markets. And you turn the spigot off to those things in those neighborhoods for half a century. And so you start to see that neighborhood, the built environment really starts to degrade at that time period. And we're still dealing with that neglect, that long neglect. The other thing that we find, which would happen later, is that the redlining practices created and a tremendous vulnerability in communities for predatory lenders. You know, in the old days, this might be loan sharks. And in more contemporary times, we'd see these as payday lenders, 15 years ago, subprime lenders. And now in these neighborhoods, we still see an emerging trend now, which is the use of land contracts. Which can be a very tricky situation for folks to get themselves in if they're trying to buy a house.
How has the Urban League, has a big role of the Urban League just been educating people about what their rights are and what to be aware of?
From an advocacy standpoint, absolutely. There is that. One of the things I think is important to just sort of underscore what Jason is talking about is when you do look at how a neighborhood is choked for that many years and the devastation that it cost. You look at the Near East Side in particular, where the Urban League headquarters actually sits right now. There was a time when it was a very thriving area. I'd get to look at a lot of the old photographs, and you look at the storefronts that were there that still exist. But when that highway came in, it basically choked the life out of that neighborhood. And so what you see today, I think, as a result of not only just educating people around fair housing initiatives, about landlord-tenant counseling, but right now, what we believe is the modern-day redlining is the issue of credit scores and not being able to, if you don't have at least a 700 credit score, it really denies you the opportunity to either buy a home, to have decent credit. You have to have, to get a job, you have to have decent credit. To be able to buy a credit card, you have to have decent credit. And so right now we see that now as the modern day redlining effect that really is crippling people of color, especially the African-American community.
Kim in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Kim.
Hi, good morning. I experienced it both as a child in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and as an adult here in Columbus on both ends. But each time it was steering. That was the issue, the less formal way of redlining.
By real estate agents, right?
Real estate agents, the whole nine yards. Mm-hmm. The lenders, what Stephanie was just talking about, it was just that level in 1968 when I was a child.
Kim, I'm glad you brought up Grand Rapids. It's another very segregated city, like
exactly.
Columbus. I grew up there. And I wanted to ask before, and I want to hear what you have to say, but before we do, Jason Reese, why are some cities still more segregated than others, or why is that?
Yeah, what we find is it really has to do with the history and how entrenched the patterns of segregation are within those places. Combined with that, as well as thinking about some of our regions here in the Midwest are hyper fragmented, right? In Northeast Ohio, we've got 300 to 400 local governments. Even here in Central Ohio, we have several hundred local governments, and so it became very hard to expand and enforce fair housing successes as the civil rights movement moved on with these small political jurisdictions that legally could get away with keeping out most affordable housing. And so it becomes very entrenched in those cities that are very fragmented. If you look at the data on how segregated cities, where they are located, you'll see that the Midwest in particular usually is proliferating the top 10 or top 20 cities nationwide.
So, Kim, go ahead. Tell us about your experience.
I respond to that question as well. I think it is what Stephanie said. If we're not at the table making the decision, then people are making decisions about where we live and where we educate our kids. What my mother said, and she's 81 now, born and raised in Michigan, was their intention was to create a golden ghetto. And that would have been Fuller Suite in Grand Rapids, Northeast Grand Rapids. Mm-hmm. They were steering all of the middle class African Americans who could get out of the city there. Her theory was, and whites would flee, as would the white teachers from the schools, et cetera. So you would have value in property that would immediately decline, and it would become just a middle class ghetto. But when I moved here, I distinctly remember asking white friends, where do you keep your black people? Because I couldn't find it. I was in Clintonville. When I bought a house, the realtor, a black female-owned firm and a black realtor, steered me to Reynoldsburg, lower-end Reynoldsburg. And this was in the 90s. I settled in Berwick because of its diversity. In my deed, there's a covenant against Jews and blacks. Mm.
Berwick being right outside of Bexley.
Berwick being in Columbus.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I don't
okay.
defer to Bexley.
Gotcha.
Okay?
Yeah.
But the most diverse neighborhood in the entire state, everybody you can think of is in Berwick. How does that work? Income, race, occupation, right? It works because we create that. We are intentional about that. So I think it goes back to what Stephanie said. If you're at the table making the decisions, then you get to create what you want.
You have that covenant now?
It's in my deed to my house.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, because Berwick was Catholic, and it still is. If you look at the remnants from Christ the King School, the parishes, they originally were excluding Jewish folks, and then African Americans.
Kim, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Take care.
Mm-hmm, bye-bye.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or a story about redlining, the practice of steering people into certain neighborhoods based on race, and you can do it in a couple different ways with covenants, like Kim just talked about, with zoning that was done back in the day, and also with how banks and real estate companies develop and who they develop for. They're the ones that put the covenants in those deeds in the first place. Probably the developers right off the bat did it. You know, Jason Rees, I read something that you said to somebody about someone in a suburb where they said, well, we don't want Section 8 in our neighborhood. And you said to them, well, who do you think works here?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
absolutely.
You know, they work in your neighborhood, but you don't want them to live in your neighborhood.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of communities, there still is this fallacy that, you know, they don't need those people, right? And unfortunately, you still get that pushback in a lot of neighborhoods. And as you said, you know, for the most part, folks who are working class here in the heart of the city of Columbus, many of them are driving out to those suburbs or taking very long bus rides. To reach those warehouses, to reach the service industries out there. And if you didn't have those people, your economy would be really hurting in those communities.
You know, and the same thing exists also with, you know, our individuals who have physical and challenges as well. You know, when you start looking at group homes, again, I live on the Near East Side. We finally got to a point when I first moved there almost 20 years ago, we had 8 group homes on Woodland Avenue, or in the 8th group homes. And so when probably about 10 years ago, when it was time to look at additional group homes being put into the communities, first place they come to is into the African-American neighborhoods. And luckily for regentrification that's happening over on the Near East Side right now, there were enough African-American or people of color along with those majority folks who said enough was enough and it's time for us to look at some other neighborhoods and some of those same neighborhoods you talked about out on the Northwest Side didn't want those group homes in their communities.
Mm. Brent in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Brent.
Hey, hi, Ann. I am a big fan of yours and longtime listener of the show. So you've got some two great guests here. One thing that I wanted to see if maybe the professor Jason Rees can expand on, one thing that I have noticed is even if you, let's just segregate it down to the city of Columbus, You could kind of see that those remnants of redlining still exist. If you go and look at the development department's master plans, you can see that the master plans, for example, like Bryce Road or your Hamilton Road, they're so outdated. They haven't been updated since probably decades, where you see the growth in like your eastern areas or like your Polaris areas. And that in itself, it really comes back to the foundations of what they were saying about the effects of redlining, where you see drainage of economic power. And what I've noticed is looking at the master plans and where they haven't been updated, it's in the predominantly minority areas where we see this lack of growth and we see this lack of reinvestment from the city and from updating master plans, which are vitally important, just like you said, where the master plans are pretty much what the city goes by when we're looking at development. So I just wanted to know if Mr. Reese can talk more about that. And then the other thing is, if Mr. Reese can give like examples, because a lot of times people throw out, you know, terms like subprime and prime, and no one who's really common knows exactly what that means or what that stands for, the direct definition of that. So
mere mortals, right? Yeah.
On that. Yeah. So yeah, if you could kind of expand on what you mean on like subprime lending and then prime lending. And then another thing to your comment.
Okay, but right. Brent, you're taking over.
I'm so happy that this could be on. So, Professor Dacey, you can go ahead and answer.
Okay,
those
sure.
Questions, I guess.
Let me start with the easy one there. So when we talk about subprime loans, and these proliferated prior to the housing crisis, you're really talking about loans that are they carry interest rates far above whatever the prime rate is at that time. So let's say, you know, hypothetically today's rates for most folks are going to be a little over 4%. Back in the subprime lending days, you'd be paying 8, 9, 10, maybe even 12, 14, almost credit card interest rates on a home mortgage. And what would happen with subprime and why it was so tricky was that usually your gateway into the loan was pretty reasonable. But you would have a rate reset at some point, and you would see your payments escalate very quickly.
These balloons.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll say, I'll make a confession, as I'm a first generation home buyer in my family, not understanding the process, and was duped by a mortgage broker into giving up my FHA loan to take what he referred to as a conventional loan, which in itself was something that ended up resetting 24 months later. And so you had a lot of people who were manipulated in the lending process to take on these loans. And the other thing that a lot of folks don't recognize is that a lot of people who got subprime loans actually qualified for prime loans. Mm-hmm. But brokers made more money off of a subprime loan, and so they directed them into that category. The other question I'll briefly just mention, I think what you're seeing there is really kind of the legacy of neglect in some of those neighborhoods. You know, we do have to think about from, and this is not just a Columbus issue, but, you know, for many cities, in terms of neighborhood development, the squeaky wheel gets the attention. And for neighborhoods that become distressed or disinvested in, where poverty really starts to concentrate, it's harder for them to get that attention. And we see that too with the neighborhood change that's going on in our community right now. Just was mentioned, you know, some of the Hamilton Road, Bryce Road, those neighborhoods that are kind of going through some transition right now, you know, they're probably not going to be at the top of the agenda because of, you know, just lacking the neighborhood leadership to really call for a lot of attention from the city. So, you know, those are places that we do need to pay attention to. But again, it's really about that legacy of neglect.
Brent, thanks a lot for that call. You know, we had another call and they dropped, but I want to raise the point they were going to make, or I think they were going to make, is they're a new immigrant. And they said they feel steered, that they're being corralled into certain neighborhoods as well. So, Stephanie Hightower, what do you know about whether this is still going on?
Well, I think when you start looking at what's happening as it relates to the evictions that are here, that are going on in Columbus right now. And you see how high the eviction rate is. A lot of this is about the ability, I'm going to go back to it again, of your credit score. If you have or don't have at least a 700 credit score, you're going to be steered towards those neighborhoods or towards those rental units.
And if you're a new immigrant, you don't have a credit score.
There you go. That's exactly right. So because you don't have the credit score, then they're going to steer you towards those neighborhoods where you don't have to worry about that in order to rent an apartment.
Ostensibly, this is all high finance, but the bottom line is it serves to segregate.
Absolutely.
And tends to do so by race.
Absolutely.
614-292-8513 is the... Oh, here he is. He's back again. Hi, Burhan?
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Did I say it right?
Yes, you said it right.
Okay.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I really love your show. And also, Cynthia Tower, thank you for coming also.
Thank you.
Professor Jason as well. It's a great topic.
Burhan, tell us about your experience.
Actually, you know, I'm advocate immigrants, Somali immigrants in local Columbus, who advocate a lot of issues, social issues.
Okay.
We see that, you know, a huge segregation in terms of, you know, the housing, you know, like you know, St. Towers mentioned, you know, there's a lot of tenant issues. There's a lot of bias toward, you know, new immigrants facing. And also, Evan, the way policy is signed, Evan, when refugees come in, Evan, is different than refugees come in East Europeans, the way they settle. And also is different than the Africans who settle from Africa, the way they settle. Because largely, a lot of immigrants who from Africa, mainly they settle African-American neighborhoods, you know. And then when you see a lot of East Europeans, when they come here, they've been settled by upper-class middle neighborhoods. And you can see those policies impact by the outcome for the long term. You know, and those are the policy by design, by mean, it'll be read, you know, the way you design. It's been designed, you know, and we see that, you know, as we're living here and myself, you know, looking the way designed the city, you know, and especially in new immigrants coming in areas that mainly welcomed by African-Americans, but also dealing with so much segregated policy, economic and name it, you know. So I'll take my question out of, you know, if Jason can talk about, you know, those policy by design, by well-mean, or something we could be want to change, be part of the changing, because we've seen this impact that has an impact for people came before us and people coming right now as well.
Yeah, it's a new great migration in its own way.
Absolutely.
Nothing like what happened in the 30s, the 20s, and the 30s, but still, Columbus is a destination.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you, Burhan.
You know, I think there's a sharp distinction between neighborhoods that are really ethnic enclaves versus neighborhoods that are rigidly segregated.
Okay.
And, you know, it's a natural phenomenon that as immigrants come into communities, you know, the part of that social support network is living near each other, but not to the degree where they're in a neighborhood where no one else is living except for immigrants, not that extreme segregation that we would see happen with the African-American community. What I would say, though, is that when we're talking about issues of steering, it really speaks to the need for greater education when it comes to the real estate industry. You know, real estate agents know that they can't say anything about race.
They know it's illegal.
Yeah, they know it's going to be illegal. What happens in the absence of that, though, is a real void in that conversation, right? And so, well, I'm not going to say anything about race, but I'm going to make an assumption that you want to live with people who look like you. And so the first six places we're going to look at are going to be neighborhoods where I think that you might be most comfortable. There's these assumptions and these implicit biases that get embedded within real estate practices. And really what's needed there is a dialogue, right? We need to be able to have a conversation about where someone wants to live in the context of wanting to live in an integrated neighborhood.
What if somebody says, I don't want to live somewhere, and they reference race? Is what's the obligation of a real estate agent at that point?
That's a really great question.
They haven't brought it up, but the client has said.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would say Certainly, the real estate agent themselves, you know, as long as they're not talking about race, I think their legal liability would be pretty minimized. But there are serious ethical issues there that I think would have to come into play.
We are going to hear from a real estate agent, retired, but remembers the days of steering. We'll hear more about that when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Columbus Urban League is celebrating its 100th anniversary, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later on. But during that century, the practice of redlining has done more to challenge the Columbus Urban League than almost anything. Now illegal, the policy encouraged banks to refuse loans to minorities for homes in certain areas, and developers and real estate companies to steer clients based on race. Still with us is CEO and president of the Columbus Urban League, Stephanie Hightower. Also with us, director of research for the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity at Ohio State, Jason Reese. You have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And as promised, I said we have a retired real estate broker. Keith, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi there. Just wanted to call in and enlighten you a little bit of how the industry worked from 1980 on to really the present. I was a real estate broker as well as a certified appraiser and owned a company under each of those categories. And the banks would love to steer on the appraisal side for low values in the areas of town that were poverty stricken and so forth, so they could have a lower loan to value on the higher priced homes in the city. So they could actually charge higher interest rates in the subprime market and make more money on those loans.
Just like Jason Reese was describing about the subprime earlier.
Yes, yes. And that was major pressure from the banks and mortgage brokers on the appraisers to actually keep those values down.
Isn't this criminal?
Pretty much, yeah. It's actually now a felony to try to coerce or steer an appraiser. Actually, realtors even can have you charged with a felony now for trying to submit information and their own comparable data to an appraiser these days. But it still goes on every hour of the day from these banks.
Wow.
You know, the interesting thing is, and I appreciate your transparency, is, you know, what folks need to understand, and this is that whole conversation that we need, as you talked about a little bit earlier, and how do we begin to have a real dialogue and conversation about race in this community and really in this country? You know, when I grew up, my family migrated from Tennessee and Kentucky and Alabama. And, you know, the one thing that we did know in the South, you knew your place. You know, so if the N-word was used or where you were supposed to live, you knew where to go. But it's when the migration started and people came north, it was these kinds of the policies and this kind of just sort of, you know, covert kinds of racism that existed in order to probably keep everybody in their places. And unfortunately, in the north, it still exists so much more today, more so than it does in the South.
Keith, thanks a lot for that call. I want to turn now to Nate in Columbus. Welcome to the show, Nate.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a small-time landlord in some of the neighborhoods being discussed. We have 10 rental units, one in Old Town East, a couple east of Parsons, down in the South End as well. And we're basically buying these properties that have been neglected for many, many years, investing some money to rehabilitate them and bring them to market rate. We're not in a luxury market at all. But I heard Ms. Hightower reference, you know, credit scores being an impediment towards people securing quality housing. And my question is, what advice would you have for landlords that want to be involved in being, you know, positive influencers in these neighborhoods and help restore buildings that need the attention? And then at the end of the day, we need to pay our bills and pay our mortgages. so we don't, you know, we're not trying to come down the wrong side of this issue. And specifically, we have, you know, rental criteria where, you know, we do require our tenants to have a 600 credit score and no delinquencies in the past 2 years. And but statistically, that person is more likely to continue to pay their bills. And, you know, I'm invested, leveraged up to my eyeballs to try and rehab these properties. Just wondering where your thoughts are there.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? I appreciate, you know, again, your honesty and transparency. Here's what I would suggest. And this is not a commercial for the Columbus Urban League, but it is. To your point, you know, we would love to be able to have a relationship with individuals like you and other folks who have rental property to send your individuals, send them to the Columbus Urban League. Get them in the 700 credit score class so that we can really, a lot of this is about coaching. Just to give you just some context, so for the second year, we've helped over 250 plus people increase their savings by an average of $1,000 each, and we've boosted credit scores by an average of 76 points. And I think that's important for people to know. We also, Nate, those same people, if you are eligible, TANF eligible, you can, the county pays for us to be able to administer those, the 700 credit score classes to those individuals for free. So you can recommend individuals to come in, or it's only $90. And again, the cohorts, every time we open one up, and they are oversold. So it really speaks to the demand. Right now, we can't keep up with the demand. And so if there's a way to partner with individuals like you, Nate, you know, to be able to say, you know, we'll pay for or we'll help or you'll sponsor individuals, that's the education is what is needed.
And Nate, how does that sound?
You know, I'm familiar with the Urban League and not familiar specifically with resources that they offer. Nor with the concept of partnering with them as a landlord. I mean, my wife and I really believe in these neighborhoods and believe in the city. Like I said, we're not invested in the luxury market, but we also, you know, no one wants 10 boarded up houses on their street.
Right.
Absolutely. So we're trying to find that middle ground. Yeah.
So, and I would strongly suggest, give us a call, ask for Brandy Avery, who is our vice president over financial services. You know, landlord-tenant issues, we deal with those. You know, we help educate folks to be able to say, look, if you can't pay your rent, if we need to help you in some way, we'll steer you in that direction, because absolutely we want to keep people in their homes. But at the same time, we also want to make sure that those landlords are being represented appropriately, too. So if we know there's a payment coming, we'll take that payment for them and make sure that the landlord gets it so that you don't have to worry about getting your rent the next month. So there are strategies and ways that we could partner. And again, if you're interested, you can call Brandy Avery and she can help you with, you know, looking at partnership opportunities or ways that we can help landlords to do a better job of ensuring that the people who are coming into their properties do the right thing. But also we want to make sure that landlords are doing the right thing as well.
Nate, Okay. Thanks a lot for your call.
Yeah, thank you. I'll definitely follow up with that.
Take care. That's great. Jason?
Yeah, well, I just wanted to acknowledge we need small investors like that who are not going to take units to luxury rates, because that's going to be critical to keeping our neighborhoods from not gentrifying. And another suggestion as well for landlords that are out there is to, one, you know, find your peers in the neighborhood. So the West Side has a landlord network where it's responsible landlords working together. And also, you know, partner with some of those local organizations where they, you know, they maybe could provide some vouching for folks. So maybe their credit score isn't great, but we can get them into a program at the Columbus Urban League. And, you know, this local community organization or church can talk about what this person's been through and you know, vouch for them. And you know, the landlords like Nate want tenants who pay every month and stay in their units. And that's what we want too.
Right?
Absolutely. You know, we want that stability for folks.
The Columbus Urban League, we've been talking in terms of race for most of the hour, and that's certainly the big issue. But Stephanie Hightower, the 700 credit score classes are not limited to people of color. They're open to all. And the registration for that is coming out, you said, told me off the air, about 50-50 at this point.
Yes. You know, the same thing goes for and our home buyer education classes. You know, this really anymore is about socioeconomics. This is not about race. This is about, you know, those individuals who are working poor, who, you know, are having a hard time, but need the support, which is what we're there to give. You know, to Jason's point, home buyer education, we do that once a month. We have the financial institutions that are our partners now. And it's to your point, you go through that home buyer education class. And from there, now you have the financial institution who knows that here's somebody who has gone through a credited program that they can now trust. They've also gone through the 700 credit score program. So now they've been validated. And so we have seen right now over, you know, 500 people have come through and have been able to go on to purchase homes, which, you know, is life changing for individuals. But it is about how do we let more people know that the Urban League is here to serve not just African-Americans or people of color, but those who are underserved in our community, those who are working poor, those who need to have, you know, that assistance and support to help them move to the next.
So it's the 100th anniversary of Columbus Urban League. And you have some plans this year.
We do. We have a new facility that will be opening on the corner of St. Clair and Mount Vernon that will house the Minority Business Assistance Center. Again, this is about, you know, a lot of what I've been talking about today is about wealth creation. How do we begin to create wealth in these underserved neighborhoods, in these neglected neighborhoods, so that we don't have to worry about those other communities coming in and taking care of our community? So this is about wealth building. We will have looking at how do we take those that entrepreneur, that emerging entrepreneur, and help that person to the next. Because you know what? That's a person who can then offer jobs. That's a person who can then contribute to the economy. So really excited about that Minority Business Assistance Center. And then we're going to be hosting the National Urban League Conference here. We're looking at probably about 7,000 to 9,000 people who register, but overall maybe about 20,000 people coming into our community. A big day will be on Saturday, which is Community Day. We'll be giving out probably about 10,000 backpacks. So for those of you who are getting ready to go back to school in August, we hope that you will come and participate that day as well. And then we have Sheryl Sandberg's coming in, Powering the Digital Revolution is our theme. And so we're hoping that she will deliver a really powerful message to us about how we can look at the disparities of people of color as we move into this new age of technology and artificial intelligence and make sure that we're there to be a part and to participate.
A whole new issue.
Absolutely.
Emerging for sure, the disparity in technology. Opening a new building, National Urban League Conference in August. A lot going on. I guess we'll have to be talking to you again later on in the year, right?
Would love to. Absolutely. Just, you know, really we appreciate what this community has done to support the Columbus Urban League. Unfortunately, you know, 100 years ago we came into existence, and it looks like based upon the disparities and a lot of the issues that we talked about today, we're going to be around for another 100 years.
What do you expect, Jason Reese? I mean, is this an ever-ending story?
Yeah, but I like to be optimistic. I think our city is going to continue to change, and the diversity of our city is going to change. And regardless of even the national political debate, we'll still see immigration decades from now. We'll see the effects of this current young generation, which is majority generation of color in our country. I think there always will be some form of struggle, but you know, we like to say that, you know, we bend towards justice, right? And so hopefully in the future we will see a more equitable city, and that'll serve to benefit everybody.
Jason Reese, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Jason Reese is an assistant professor of city and regional planning at the OSU Knowlton School of Architecture and director of research for the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. And also Stephanie Hightower, thanks again for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Stephanie Hightower is the CEO and president of the Columbus Urban League. Thanks for all the great calls. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.